Next on the agenda is Operations Report, San Juan Island EMS. Chief Goodson.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Our report, much like Pam was saying, ours is pretty typical for the month. You have, the report was made available. I just want to hit some of the highlights. Our call volume year-to-date is going up. We have 39 more calls this year than we did the previous year, so that's showing a 7% increase. The average EMTs per call, 3.5. You may have noticed that that's changed because I changed the way I'm reporting the data. I looked and said previously, the way both Chief Martin and my first couple reports, we looked at the volunteer EMTs responding. We did not account for the paramedics or the staff EMTs in their response to these incidents. And I thought it was a much better metric to include how many personnel we actually have on scene, regardless of whether they're volunteers or paid staff. And so adjusted accordingly. So that's why you see a bit of an increase in the numbers, because that includes the paramedics and the staff EMTs on response.
So it should say average EMTs and paramedics?
Oh, we can do that.
But it does include the paramedics.
Yeah, technically, paramedics are EMTs. Yeah. They're just EMTPs. Yeah. No, they've changed that designation.
They've changed it, yeah.
That's right, they did on me. So I can
that's
make that tweet.
Okay.
Absolutely. And you can see that our average response times are still within our rural benchmarks. Actually, we generally have response times within what are called suburban benchmarks, and I've gone through and adjusted for where on the island those calls were located. You probably noticed that we had 129 calls, but I have data for location for 117 calls, and was desperately trying to figure out why that was happening, and realized that the location on the island of where the incident occurs was an optional checkbox. So we changed that, so now it's a forced checkbox, and you have to make a decision. You have to be able to say, we were on the north end of the island, we were in town. So hopefully that data will get more true as we come through and account for all the calls that were going on. I'm still working on shoot times. Shoot time, if you're not familiar with the term, that's the time between the page and the time the ambulance rolls. So as opposed to response time, which is the time of page to arrival on scene. And of course, with the addition of staff EMTs, that's the metric we're really interested in. How fast is the ambulance getting out the door? And we're narrowing in on it. Ryan Nelson, who Pam mentioned before, is our tech person on site, and Robin DeLizardo with the Sheriff's Dispatch Office. We're working on using their dispatch program to do those analytics, and we're getting close, not quite there yet. Hopefully, I'll have them for you soon. And the nice thing about using the Sheriff's Dispatch Office for that data is they have data all the way back to 1999. And if we can figure out the right parameters, I should be able to give you a 2019 comparison to 2018, what we did and didn't have staff people there. So hopefully those are coming
so
for you.
So you have 2018 data for when the ambulance was rolling, and you can look back and analyze.
We should be able to.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, which is very cool. Okay. And we should then be able to show, anecdotally, we all kind of know. Mm-hmm. We're rolling much faster, but I want to be able to give you hard numbers and give you all hard numbers as well.
Yeah, we're paying for more staff, so we'd love to be
able to tell you
this is the result. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think we've covered that. So, good. Our financial picture is looking pretty good. We have revenues of $90,160 in, brings us to $1.4 year to date, which is 47.5% of our budget projections. Expenses are $172,000, bringing us to about $1.3 million year to date, which is 43.6% of our budget projections. So we seem to be on track with that. The interesting thing, again, is GEMT, obviously bringing in a lot more revenue than we had first anticipated, which is great. We're almost 400% above what we had projected. Also to note, I just received yesterday information from the Healthcare Authority, which is the governing body that manages the GEMT project. And as you recall, we had to pay out $96,000 in order to get money. The Nigerian prince is living up to their bargains. We've gotten payment from one of the five managed care organizations in the amount of $83,380. So we're only about $13,000 in the hole yet. But there are projected $352,000 coming in from the four remaining, with the bulk of the payment coming from Molina Healthcare as the major payer out here for the managed care organization in our agency. So that's very good news. Let's see what else. I want to let you know that a meeting with our accountant, Ms. Compton, we're working on the 2019 amended budget. I have assurances that we should have that for the August meeting. So we'll have the amended 2019 budget. Chief Collins and I, along with Chris, to some extent, will be looking at the 2020 budget. That is due in October, and we're on track for getting that to you as well. So just to let you know that as we've been directed from the community advisory group, that we're not looking at our budget solely in unilaterally one silo. We're working together to kind of see where our both fire department's budget, EMS budget, and working to try to synchronize those and make them make sense for both organizations as we move toward integration. To update you on the community, we have had 8 CPR and first aid classes, another 38 people during the month of June. Including personnel from Camp Norwester, so we're up to 330 community members who've been educated this year alone. With operations, still working on our metrics, we're kind of fine-tuning that and honing that down. That we're feeling very good about that. Chief Collins and I, we're also looking at getting the mobile data terminals up to speed. That's the word I'm looking for. I just blanked all of a sudden. The grant money that we received to get the hardware into place that Chief Martin found, you know, the hardware's there, it's set and ready to go. We found out that it wasn't compatible with the existing Sheriff's Department dispatch system. They've made their upgrades. We're there. We've got one terminal online. We're doing some tweaks to that before we bring the others up to line. But everything's been updated. We should be good. We're working on getting that together as well. What else have we got going on? Chief Collins and I have also opened up some communications with dispatch in terms of radio frequencies. We both feel pretty strongly that we should be operating on a single frequency for both fire and EMS. That way we stop having these interoperability problems if we're all listening to one channel, not relying on scanning the other ones going on. The nice thing about that, we can do that before the whole new CODAN radio upgrade project happens. That also allows us 3 frequencies to work with that are monitored by dispatch and that can be shared by both agencies. So regardless of what frequency we pick for the initial page out, we have 2 others in reserve that if we have multiple incidents, one incident can be on one channel, another incident can be on another channel to keep from stepping on radio traffic. But we have a total of 3 that can be monitored and played back with tape recordings if we need to do any sort of after-action response and looking for that for information coming from those logs. So that's something we're working with as well.
Carl, is it TAC 3 and 4, they're not... they're not taped, is that the issue?
That's correct.
You can't get, okay.
That's correct. So we can't, and generally, at least with the fire department, their kind of standard is once they're arrived on scene and they want to start working the scene, they switch to a tactical channel, which is a line of sight simplex. For those of you, it's not monitored if there's not enough power to get to dispatch, so they don't monitor that. The problem with that is if we get into a situation where we need additional resources and everybody's on TAC 3, dispatch doesn't know about it. If somebody gets themselves into trouble and a mayday goes out, dispatch doesn't hear it. So it's up to command to be listening to all that and make sure that's happening. We can run the scene, and the idea was not to overwhelm the dispatchers. However, we can still run the scene and have that intercommunication that I think is so important. So we're working toward that, you know, right off the bat. And Robin DeLazare, who's the lead dispatcher, seems to be right on board with that. So we'll make those things happen. Are the resident MPD, the resident doctor program is in full swing over at Peace Island Emergency Department. Generally, over the course of the summer, they bring in MDs for their residence rotation for rural emergency room medicine. And there are four people who have been tapped to come here to Friday Harbor. We've seen two of them already. Dr. Didi Souza, who's a UW grad, and Dr. Jack Ludwig. And I can't remember where Dr. Ludwig came from. But they're both here in residence at the ED right now and are all geared up for ride-alongs with us. The idea being that they're working in the emergency department. They want to see what's going on our rigs. They hopefully can get a flight, whether that's with Airlift or with Island Air, and kind of see what the overall program looks like in a rural area like this. And it's met with very, very good success. In fact, Dr. Hasler, who's our supervising physician, was one of those doctors who came here and did a residency tour at our ED and ended up taking a position in Port Angeles and then becoming our supervising physician. So they're all very, very excited. I got to get like the fire under one of them. He tends to amble over. We're moving too fast. He's missed the ambulance a couple of times. But that's all right. We'll get him moving. And of course, that depends on what their workload is like in the emergency department as well. Fatigue assessment. I did mention that we did have one in June, but I think I mentioned it in the last meeting, and that was due to a high stress call where one of our medics tapped out. But we had plenty of backup, and so we were not short-staffed at all with that. Anything else that I want to let you know? Our medical protocols, the ALS protocols, are stalled for obvious reasons. With the change in the MPD, things aren't moving. So hopefully, as that situation gets resolved, then the ALS protocols will be resolved also, and we can get that put away and put to bed. There are a couple of things that we're going to need to go back and amend, and I didn't mention this in my report, but we're going to need to have additions to the BLS protocols. The State Department of Health has had some new situations where basic EMTs are able to administer more medications. So epinephrine, even though that's part of our protocols, that has now been formalized, nebulized. Albuterol is another thing that our EMTs are going to be able to do. Zofran is another medication that basic EMTs will be able to administer. And CPAP, which is a continuous positive airway pressure unit. We already do that, but now it's going to become formalized by the state and become required of all basic EMTs. And so that nebulized albuterol and the Zofran will have to be added to our protocols, and then we'll have to bring our EMTs up to speed on that. So there'll be additions, amendments to the BLS protocols. That should go relatively smoothly. To let you know about our 2019 EMT class, we're down to three students who still need to take the exam and get that passed. All the others have passed the exam. We're still also waiting for the state to finalize their licensure. When you look at their status, it all says pending, even though they've passed everything, all the paperwork's in. We're just waiting for the state to say yes. So that brings us up to six total who are poised and ready to go, and they're all responding on calls. Our administrative assistant, and I think I mentioned this before, Heather Vogel has joined the team.
Yay.
So she's here as Diane had moved on to the county. And She's doing really well. It always amazes me. It's a very complicated job. There's lots of bits and pieces and flying parts, and she's managing to get them all together, and we're getting everything done, so that's great. The warrants are getting paid, and the payroll is being processed, and all those important things are being taken care of. So,
and she's
welcome,
still
Heather.
Smiling.
It's something big.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Give it a couple.
Give her time. Give her time. So, just trying to hit some of the highlights here. Community paramedicine. I do want to mention that we have been able to coordinate with dispatch. One of the current concerns we had is when Lainey went out on calls for community paramedicine, she'd let somebody in the office know, she'd go out and do the call, and then come back. And we started thinking that's maybe not the safest situation for her. Sometimes something can screw up a patient, things can go a little sideways. So we wanted to make sure that she was able to be tracked by dispatch to know when she was going out on a call and when she returned from a call. So she has her own call sign now, Community Paramedicine, CP3, District 3. Zero. So she's CP30.
No problem.
I'm a Star Wars.
We'll remember that.
Anyway, it's close. I'm waiting for the dispatchers to call her 3PO. That's what I'm hoping for, but it hasn't happened yet. So anyway, Lainey will then call into dispatch. They have a 30-minute timer on her. If she does not report back, they'll send the cavalry, basically. So I'm feeling really good about that. Hopefully Lainey is feeling very good about that. And that's moving forward. Let's see, we do have all the pieces in place with the reporting software. Our ESO, which is the medical report writing software, interfaces now with Gelato, which is community paramedicine writing software. Our EMTs and paramedics can come across a patient and push that with just a push of a button, send a medical record into Gelato, so Lainey's alerted to that and can get them into the program. So we make the referrals from EMS right to community paramedicine with the reporting software, which is very exciting, and it's working. It seems to be working very, very well. The other thing that I wanted to update you on was the status with our MPD, our medical program director. As you probably are aware, we had two candidates who showed interest in taking over Dr. Sullivan's position as the medical program director for San Juan County. That was Dr. Kerry Matthews, who is here at the Peace Island Medical Center in the emergency department. She's a board certified emergency room physician, some experience with, I believe it was the Navy, where she did a lot of work, handled a lot of Marines. So that was, you know, good on her. The other doctor that was interested was Dr. Joshua Korska, who is out of Providence, Everett. He's a trauma surgeon, and both candidates were interviewed yesterday. And of those two candidates, the county trauma council reached consensus and put forward a recommendation. The hospital also puts forward a recommendation, and my understanding is that the same candidate was recommended by both entities. So now it's in the hands of the Department of Health. They'll vet the candidate, make sure that everything is, yeah, all the T's are crossed and the I's dotted, and then let us know if, you know, that is the, they support that, our recommendation. And once we know that, we'll let the two candidates know, and then we'll let everyone else know who the new medical program director is. Lainey, is there anything else that I need to add to that?
No, I haven't got the email yet.
Okay. Lainey has been the person who has coordinated the efforts of the County Trauma Council and took care of coordinating everything, getting the interviews lined up, getting all the players involved here, and all the voting members were here, which was wonderful. Save one. We had
but
one
he
telephone.
Was on the phone.
He was on the phone. So everybody else was here in person and able to meet with the two candidates. So that was that went well. Fire integration. The integration steering committee is continuing to meet pretty regularly. Generally, the whole group meets every other week. There are subcommittees out there, then we're meeting as necessary. Right now, the Gantt chart, which is kind of the critical pathway organization program, has been updated. There's been some critical deadlines been added to that. The two big ones are the vote for town annexation, which is scheduled to take place in the spring of 2020. So that means it has to be on the ballot in November. Is that right?
Yes.
April, August. I thought.
No, they changed it from April to
It's August. In August, has to be on the ballot, for the and the vote takes place in April.
Yeah, I think Duncan said it was going to be, he thought April was too soon.
Okay.
Oh.
I think that was the last meeting. But we're still discussing that.
Right,
so we'll find out all the details.
So that's one piece that tends to be driving the timeline for this. The other piece that's driving the timeline is licensure. So right now, EMS, our license renewal happens in November. So to match all the meetings of both the county trauma council and the regional trauma council, we're looking at having all the paperwork ready for submittal September 1st. And we're on track for that. We're hoping to get the fire's initial application for a BLS aid license submitted at the same time. However, that's not as time critical. We should be on track for that to get them both on. But their initial application is probably going to take longer to review and finalize than our renewal license will. But we are on track with that.
Was the town council met last week? Was that the decision that they made then? Because the last I heard, they had talked like hypothetically about February on the ballot, too soon, April on the ballot, is now too soon, and we're talking August next week.
That I don't recall from the town council meeting. I know that the working session that I attended with Commissioner German and Commissioner Appleton, they were talking about whether or not to put it on the ballot, whether or not they wanted to support it, and then what kind of measure that would look like for the town. Whether they would hold back, they would just add a new fire levy, or a fire measure, I should say, or they would hold some of that money that they currently collect in town property taxes in reserve. They would dedicate it. There were seven different options. And it certainly seemed like all the town council members were in support of annexation. They just weren't sure what proposal to put onto the ballot. So that had not been finalized at the end of that meeting. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure the timeline had been set.
And
either.
I think that's right. Until they talk about that more, I think that's why it's kind of in flux right now.
Understood.
They need to know what option they're going to choose.
Right. So that's scheduled for another meeting.
So Nathan, do you have anything to add as far as this timeline? I'm sort of confused. The two
yep.
different considerations I take today.
So my understanding was, and hopefully this doesn't just muddy the waters more, was that originally we were looking at a February date for annexation of town, and then at the last meeting, Duncan said they wanted to do it in April. And so if you're going to have it on an April ballot, it's got to be turned in 60 days in advance. So there's all these different dates that you have to meet to get something done. That was my understanding.
And so I think probably what I was saying was, getting it onto the ballot, I was using the February ballot measure and inadvertently really forgot. And then I knew that they were talking about an April ballot. I didn't realize that correspondingly that moves up. That's my bad math.
It gets confusing fast, and there's no final decision on it, but that's my understanding where we were left at. So
right now, those are the big timeline crunches. Otherwise, everything else is moving. We're trying to move as quickly as we can to resolve the issues. The other thing that the Integration Steering Committee kind of came up with as we look at the individual recommendations and the issues that we were charged to come up with a plan for, certain pieces we would feel like we would have a good solid recommendation to bring forward. And I can, you know, and we will alert you as those are made. But as far as a final, we're not going to ask for any sort of vote or, you know, anything formalized until the entire process is done. So as it stands right now, and maybe Commissioner Smith, you would rather talk about it in your portion of committee reports, but I'm happy to take it. Right now, we looked at the issue that was tagged as the composition of the board, whether or not that the board of commissioners for that integrated EMS fire unit would consist of the three members that it is currently of the fire district commissioners, or would be more like the five members of the current public hospital district. The CAG's recommendation was that it would go to five, and that was because they felt that they wanted to be able to provide representation from the town, as well as somebody who maybe had some medical background. Subsequently, both Commissioner Smith and Commissioner Cardinale took a look at this and went back into the law and realized you cannot legally say that list qualifications for a board member. You can impose geographical restrictions on the board member, but you can't say, you know, that they have certain levels of experience or certain types of backgrounds. So after much deliberation and looking at other like agencies throughout the state, their recommendation is to maintain the three-member board. So that's the recommendation both Commissioner Cardinale and Commissioner Smith came up with, due to the and there's quite a list of supporting pieces of evidence to justify that decision. So the Integration Steering Committee felt very comfortable with the amount of research that they did and looking at the reasoning behind the recommendation to maintain three. So we felt that particular issue has been put to bed. So obviously our job now is to report back to you as a board and get your input to find out if there's anything we need to bring back. So obviously we can.
What were the reasons in support of maintaining a three-person board?
Two-page report, and it's posted on the website. So I mean, there were basically there are no volunteer departments of our size or even bigger that have five members. They're all three members. The original RCW statute states that you have three members and that you have reasons for adding to that. The only five-member boards in the state of Washington are those populations. They're not rural populations, they're city populations, and they're over, I can't remember what the population was, but a lot more than we are. You're talking 100,000 or 120,000, I think was the minimum. So that was some. And then there were a whole lot of other research that actually Frank did first that had a list of pros and cons for large boards and small boards. And if you want to look that up on the website, it has every piece of information we could gather.
Yeah, I didn't bring it with me, but yeah, it is available.
What we're doing is the subcommittees are gathering information, and then we're making recommendations to the steering committee. The steering committee is making decisions, and then that, as they're approved, is being posted on the website. And then that's what Carl is referring to, is instead of doing it piecemeal, we're just going to bring the whole package in and say these are everything to the two boards for the recommendation, which is down the road a ways because there's so many pieces to it.
Well, there are limitations to having a three-person board versus a five.
There are.
And, my concern in that is that it leaves the chief with, a disproportionate, a larger amount of power, it seems to me, just in that the board couldn't form a subcommittee of two because that violates the Open Public Meetings Act and such. So it restricts the board.
There's actually some positives to that, too. It's very good. With a five-person board, you can have serial discussions. And so that was one of the issues that was brought up by the fire commissioners when we talked about this originally. So you can talk to two people who talk, and one person can really talk to another person, and then you can have that serial discussion, which is very difficult sometimes to control because you're trying to get information and talk. With a three-person board, it's very clear. You don't talk to anybody. So there's the two sides of it. So.
Generally the chief administrator then becomes kind of the liaison and between the board members until the open public meeting.
And one of the other keys was that board has been a three-person board since the inception when EMS and fire were together. So they've never been more than three persons.
So I would hope that, please go in and take a look at that, at those recommendations, and if there's specific questions, make us aware of it so that we can answer that question for you, or take a look further down the path and make sure that everybody's comfortable with the recommendations come through. The last thing I have for you is just kind of a special report on our outreach project. And again, as I mentioned in my email, I apologize for the late start. I'm hoping that you all have a chance to take a look at it. What's come to our attention as we're working on these projects that we have is not only do we have a 911 response that we take care of, but we've created a bunch of community outreach kind of projects. I outlined what most of them are. I kind of break them down into basically community education, safety programs, and then the community paramedicine program. The community education takes care of all the classes that we teach, the AHA classes, the solo classes, first aid, CPR, wilderness kinds of things. The other thing that we have are safety programs where we do things like car seats and bike helmets and flotation devices for kids that are available out on dock. Most of those are done through grants. And the other big project is the community paramedicine project. The fortunate part about that is that all those projects, I think, serve our community very, very well. They, especially the education, help with our CPR resuscitation rates and the survivability rates. That couldn't be accomplished if we didn't have a citizenry that understands the process, that gets trained, that is willing to step up and help their neighbors. So that makes the community really, really strong. It makes EMS strong, and it makes us all look good, and does great by our community. Same thing with the car seat program, the bicycle, helmet program. As is often said in our business, is if we roll the ambulance out the door, we didn't do our job. The idea is to keep the communities safe, to educate them, to try to make sure that nobody needs to call us. Granted, that's a goal. That's not, it's an attainable goal, but it's definitely something to strive for. And I think we're doing a lot of those things. The community paramedicine program makes a lot of sense. We're realizing it, on the surface, anecdotally, knowing that we're seeing people who we call frequent flyers, people who called 911 because they felt they had no other choice, and causing us to have to make a response, bringing them to the emergency room, not typically in things that would be considered emergency situations. It had more to do with managing their health care. The community paramedicine program is designed to target those kinds of that kind of population, to get out to them, to help them manage their health problems and other problems before it gets to crisis and they feel they have no other choice. That was what the community paramedicine program was designed to do. We've signed on for that. We have some contractual obligations that we said there's our program, our falls prevention program, had gotten to a point where we're ready to make a big step forward, and money was available. So Chief Martin had decided, yes, let's pursue this. I think we can make this work. The unfortunate part about all these wonderful programs that we have is that they all kind of got dumped into one pool, and that's outreach and education. That's Director Volk's bailiwick. And now she's basically doing three jobs. And so we've gotten to a point where we're realizing this is difficult to sustain. So we looked at how can we address this problem. And we really looked at three different options. One of those is we just continue on and hope for the best. And I think that that's not realistic. We're going to create a situation where somebody's health suffers, they're burned out, or worst case scenario is they give themselves a heart attack and then they become another one of our statistics. The second option would be to cut back on some of those programs, either discontinue a program or cut back on some of those programs. My personal feeling, as well as that of the staff, is that we'd rather not do that. Again, we have contractual obligations with community paramedicine, and why eliminate other successful programs or scale back other successful programs? The third one is basically to try to increase staffing. So how do we do that? We had discussed the possibility of trying to formalize that community paramedicine program. We have people who are interested in helping Director Volk with that, that program. The one individual who is really interested in helping out is one of our paramedics. That opens up a whole can of worms with, you know, the existing contract. And that's a major change in work conditions. At this time, maybe we're not ready to do that. But then we started looking at just the sheer amount of time that is taken up by scheduling, correspondence, follow-up, data tracking. So those kinds of pieces seem to be something that we can do with a clerical kind of position. So that was the solution that seemed to bubble to the top. So that's kind of what we looked at. I tasked our staff people to say, tell me how much time you spend on that sort of thing. What we came back with is I outlined in option three, and I think realistically we can say we can definitely fill a halftime position with those kinds of clerical issues. Not only are they outreach kind of issues, but we can do that with other things that we do logistically in terms of when Caitlin Johnson was here as a full-time logistics coordinator, she took care of medical supplies and drug orders and dealing with our vendors. When Director Coons of 911 was also handling our training and education, there was lots of clerical kinds of pieces that needed to be tracked to make sure that the EMTs were maintaining their certification and making so that when times came for renewal for our licensure, for their licensure, they were up to speed. The coordination of then the calendar for these outreach programs, these are all clerical positions. We feel like we can fill that with a halftime position. So putting that out there, I realize that we're kind of in a very strange situation. We are in kind of a status quo kind of situation until we can actually make the integration happen. But I'm afraid that we don't want to equate status quo with treading water. We don't want to tread water. We want to be swimming toward a common beachhead. And I think we can make that happen. The fact that we've got our amended budget coming up, we can start looking at how the revenues that we got for 2019, some of those unexpected, how those fit in and how we justify those, what we carry forward. The 2020 budget is coming up ready. Chief Collins and I are already saying we need to look at these budgets together. Me being involved with what the fire budget is, he being involved with the EMS budget is, and trying to coordinate that. So I'm hoping that by alerting you as the board to this situation, that I feel like I can move forward and get you a solid, fleshed out, meat on the bones kind of proposal and show you how that this might work with the monies that we have coming in, the monies that we plan on having coming in, and how this comes together with fire, for you to be able to say, go forward. See if you give me something solid. Give me something with, you know, meat on the bones, and we'll talk about getting some help in here. So that was the basis of this report, and I leave that for you guys to take a look at. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
I have one request. Please. So you're going to be presenting a more detailed proposal, and we're looking at a 2020 budget process. So those two things together are going to be. And you're going to need to know what the 2020 budget is.
Right.
So, Kent, and we've talked about this before, about splitting out first of all, having separate line items for your capital expenditures and your capital projects so that we know what are we talking about, what kind of money do we need, 1 year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, which you can run out with, you know, ambulances and equipment, expensive equipment and that. So we need to have a better idea of that, because that will offset the monies coming in, like
absolutely,
the EMT monies and ACH monies, which if you take those out, in the absence of those monies coming in, you need to look at it, and you talked about it, the sustainability of these programs.
Right.
So I think that that's one of the things we need, is that that capital expenditures long term, and besides the other details, mm-hmm, and detail it out for however long, at least 10 years.
I'd throw the life packs in there too. That's a major acquisition.
Yes.
Any major equipment for sure.
Yeah. But going back a little bit, I think that the three main points you talked about, up to and including conferring with Fire 3,
mm-hmm,
in terms of doability, desirability, and being able to pay for it, I think you're spot on. So I encourage you to compile those things with Chief Collins' input, and then at the next board meeting, show us the bones on the...
I'm hoping that if I can get something solid for you, I'll try to get that to you as soon as possible, so that we may even be able to, through whatever we need to get approvals, maybe even before the next board meeting, because I know we're a lot of us have our feelings of crunch, and if we can get you a good solid proposal, I'm gonna get it out to you as soon as I can, for you to take a look at, and then maybe we'll be able to discuss this and maybe come up with something before the next board meeting. That's kind of my hope. And also to let you know that as we're looking at this, you know, the ACH money, we figured out basically what we've got. What we've received over the 2 years is close, it's $187,000. That was specifically earmarked. What I've now requested is specific BARS code so that we can track this money as it's going out and how we start to reallocate. And it's a situation that we've looked at previously, where I think a lot of times, because of this small organization and the tightness of it, we found an individual and created a job description for the individual. These are lots of things. This person can do this and this and this and this. Whereas instead of having what the job is and finding a person to fill it, we had the person and created all the tasks that they did. And I think that's kind of bass backwards. We want to make sure that we know what the jobs are that we need to fill. And one person may be able to take on one of those jobs and a portion of the other, where another person, we need to come up with the plan for the individual to take care of the jobs that need to be filled, rather than to create a bunch of jobs for an individual. So we're working toward that, and I think both Chief Collins and I realize that clerically, that's a good first step. And then we need to develop good, solid plans with goals that we can then start saying, all right, maybe it's time to take, you know, to create that job, the formalized community paramedicine job, and move somebody into that, which then opens up another position, you know, that another person can take on, let's say, the educational portion, where teaching the classes. So those are the plans, and that's the proposal I hope to get to you that's good, solid, and maybe has a couple of options for you to take a look at and review.
And the 2020 budget's due in November to us?
October, I think.
October finished, and we get it in the October meeting.
I'm going to try.
We start working on it in August,
yeah.
And a draft usually comes out in September, and then you have 30 days. It's on the website, everybody, and then you come back in October and do kind of a final. It's technically due to the county by the end of November.
Okay.
But
so that's why
we have it
in October.
Try to have it done by the October.
Yeah.
But that's a drop-dead date.
Yeah.
Okay. Because you probably need some input from the 2020 budget in order to come back with
right, because sustainability is the key.
Yeah.
Okay. Absolutely.
Excellent. Thank you.
Were there any other questions?
No.
No, it just sounds like, you know, that you have to define what the job is and how it's going to be broken apart. So like a job description as to who's going to take on what. I think the employees within the agency that can take on.
Well, I think we're gonna have to hire somebody, you know, onto staff instead of, you know, we can find volunteers, you know, part of our volunteer crew that can fill that position, mm-hmm. all the better. Thank you.
I know I missed the audience participation because I was.
No, you haven't. No, you haven't yet.
Oh, okay, then I'll wait.
You have to stay till then.
I'm not going to choose you, though. Thank you, Chief. Good thing. Appreciate it. So keep me in the loop in terms of the urgency of this and your progress. You know, worst case, we could call a special meeting if you feel it's, you know, crucial in terms of the time frame.
I appreciate that.
And now, secondary to Wayshaw's version, we have the audience participation period. Well, you're last out of us. So, anyone else? Karen?
No, thank you.
Okay, Dan.
So, I just wanted to. I think Carl did a great job telling you guys what's going on, but left out a crucial piece, and that is with the advent of adding the community paramedicine piece. Lainey, who was already working really two jobs. Was tasked with doing the community paramedicine piece. And with that, she's slowly added patients. So it used to be that it was just EMS that referred patients to her, but now San Juan Healthcare Associates, the health department, and PIMC are referring patients to her. So she has a really full caseload and really is doing three jobs and is sort of about to come undone, honestly. She can't maintain what she's doing. She spent 30 years developing all of the prevention programs that we have and is reluctant to cut back on that, but we don't have many classes scheduled until September. With hiring EMTs, a lot of those EMTs would teach, but because they're full-time employees, we can't pay them overtime. So Lainey's tasked with doing more instruction than she was even before. And so is just at that tipping point where she is not just asking for help, but she's crying out for help and saying, you guys, I cannot maintain this. With that $186,000 that we've gotten from the ACH to cover that community paramedicine piece, I'm hoping, you know, if she could, so in our discussions, some of the things that we talked about is, this is a trial. So it's a 3-year trial, and Lainey's gonna retire sometime in the next 2 to 3 years is her plan. If that isn't continued on and funded, she'll just retire and be out, it'll go away, unfortunately. I don't think that'll happen. I think that that's gonna be a standard of care soon. They're modeling both Orcas, North County, and Whatcom Sevens program after the program that Lainey put together. She gets calls weekly asking how, because people have heard in the region how well it's going. And so she really needs some help taking stuff off of her plate, and with that ACH money, in my mind, which is not budgetary at all, it's all patient care focused. So disregard any of my financial wizardry, but I'm thinking that ACH money can go to fund that community paramedicine, which is where it's supposed to go. And so there's lots of money left that is budgeted for me. So my plea to you and to Carl is that we do, if it's at all possible, fast track to get things involved. And Norman's been at our staff meetings, and he and Carl have been brainstorming. They have a community prevention and outreach program that, you know, if we can fund and have somebody help Lainey, that when we merge, that will be a position that will both be fire and EMS that serves the community. I'm done. This is up. Thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you.
It was 2 minutes and 58 seconds.
I did a good job.
Thank you, Waysha. Appreciate it. Thank you, Chief. Okay, now we move on to unfinished business, and first order there, committee reports, CCC. We'll start with that.
Well, you all received this, I'm assuming, and we had our community health assessment topic at the CCC. I think we all left feeling pretty positive about the collaboration, and we're looking forward to the Jody Corona's report being done in
September,
and so we can start taking action on some of our shared goals. I don't know how much else I need to share with you. It's sort of all here. Mark had some time to talk to you.
Yeah, Dr. Appleton graciously allowed me to take his place for that meeting. And so we talked about the helipad, and under the auspices of Tom Cable, there will be a committee formed, and it is yet to be formed, to study the question. It's not our priority, so going forward, we'll just have to see how that works out. But they do have an interest in addressing our 2.2.2 subsidy agreement issue or concern with respect to a helipad and how that would relate to better patient care here in the island. So the wheels are turning on that.
Any sense of the timeline given the latest CCC meeting?
None whatever.
And have you had a chance to confer with Tom Cable?
Yeah, I did by email, and he just said that the committee has not yet been formed.
Very good. So, well, integration.
You've
heard a lot about that.
We have. Yeah. So, I won't repeat things. We talked about town annexation. We've had two meetings since the last PhD meeting, and we're going to probably have two or three in between this one and the next one. We did talk about the outer islands. At the time, which was the last meeting, we needed some more information. We're gathering that information, and that will be presented at the next meeting with the recommendation. Carl reviewed the licensing timelines, which he's already talked about. We went through messaging, communications, public education, and outreach, discussed the need for coordinated message and facts that can be distributed and used in public forums, and Nathan is working with Chuck on that. Yes, Allison. Yes. And will be action items. That is an action item, so we'll be coming back and talking about this on the next meeting, which happens to be Monday. So we'll be talking about the district boundaries, which has to do with outer islands, service levels, a levy, and the dates for the outreach meetings and budgeting. And as I said, all of the information is posted on the website as the information is approved by the steering committee. And there's a lot of discussion about all these individual things. We don't have a lot posted yet because we're still in the process of putting it in place. So it's moving along quickly.
Very good. Thank you, Rebecca. So next is EMS and Trauma Care Council news.
That's me. So Lainey and I went down to Burlington this month and attended. And the North Region EMS and Trauma Council, this time there were representatives from 10 regional hospitals, fire and EMS from 12 agencies, air medical from 3 agencies, and the Department of Health folks were on the phone. So there's a lot of people in these. They have a great quality improvement committee, QAQI. They share data about, in this particular instance, the two meetings were cardiac and outcomes, this meeting rather. The hospitals themselves are really trying to reduce their times from patient arrival or 911 calls to transport or transfer to another hospital. So that's a big push for them, for the hospitals, and they're doing really well. They also talked about fireworks-related trauma. Most areas have seen a reduction, and we're really lucky here because fireworks are prohibited, and all the other areas we're asking how they can do that. So they want to have it too. That doesn't mean that we don't have fireworks here. We certainly do, but we have very few, and we have very few injuries compared to what they have off island. They talked about the more we push the message about the dangers, and as 4th of July comes up, it's a good idea to, you know, all just tell everybody about it. In our neighborhood, we have signs that we put up a week before that remind people there's no fireworks and explains it, and it's right there at the beginning of the neighborhood, so that's a possibility. We talked about outreach focus on cardiac and stroke calls. Interesting, on the region-wide, the numbers of people responding in their own vehicles and delaying calling 911 are increasing, except for here. Our county does a really good job, and our county, and they also talked about the medics doing a very good job of reading EKGs and getting people in faster and transferred to places faster. Paramedics were complimented. We talked about PulsePoint, which is a mobile phone app that's tied into dispatch. You're still working with dispatch on that. It's still in process, but this is a program that you can put on your phone, and anybody who has CPR training would be notified within like a quarter mile area. So if there's somebody having a heart attack down, you know, in the mall that you're shopping in, wherever you are that has this pulse point, you would get a tone on your phone, and you could go help. It's a real plus for people like the South Enders that the program down in the Cape and Cattle Point have, because right now they're trying desperately to figure out a way of notifying everybody, and the only way right now they have is to have somebody go in and ring the bell at the fire station, which is very old and rusty, but it still works. But it takes too much time. So we're hoping something like that, and then the other neighborhoods could get on board with that. And they talked about that quite a while. And they talked about community paramedicine. Other counties are working with the Department of Health to define laws and scope of practice in this area, and I think that's going to be a legislative commitment. And the ALS protocols we talked about here that we were still working on. This was actually not in the North Region Trauma Care Council, but in the County Trauma Council. I believe that they have a meeting next month where the county medics are all going to get together and talk about the protocols, the ALS protocols, and go over what they have. I think MIC is more than 50% done with putting them in a format, so we're moving along. That's it. Any questions?
No, pretty good.
Thanks, Rebecca. Next item is entitled Transition from Kaiser LifeWise and Paramedical Transport Denials. Pam, you covered a fair amount of that. I'll try not to reiterate what you've shared so far. You mentioned the long-standing desirability of having the Kaiser Permanente physicians meet with our physicians. That's been out on our table at least for probably 4 months now, and there's been no response. The last time we conferred with the Office of the Insurance Commissioner, they assured us that they would facilitate that meeting. That was many, many weeks ago. It hasn't happened yet, so past occurrences tend to portend future ones. That said, the good news is that thanks to Pam and a few others, particularly Ann Preston, who's the superintendent for PhD 2 and 3, Lopez and Orcas respectively, have been champions in terms of carving pathways to not only LifeWise, but also Primera, the mother company, in terms of executive representation on their part, understanding what we're all about, understanding our needs, and wanting to be proactive in terms of not only addressing the specifics of the myriad of policies that they might offer, including Medicare Advantage, but also the fiasco, frankly, we've had with Kaiser Permanente with regards to aerobatic transport. So I don't have a lot of hope that KP is going to come around. You know, they've already have formulated their exit strategy, but looking forward, I think we have a very good chance, again, thanks to Pam and Ann Preston, to get them to understand what we're all about and make accommodations. It wouldn't be unprecedented for them to do so, but you have to push to get your way, so to speak. As a corollary, there's also on the table, and it's been discussed off and on for a number of months now, and that is to get legislative relief. We know that the Association of Washington PhDs does that and have been very successful in times past, as has the Washington State Hospital Association. Unfortunately, with regards to the PhD organization, we recently lost the longstanding executive director, and so that organization has been put back on their heels. That said, they're willing and able, and in conference with Oscar Ray of MRSC, we have assurances that they will, as soon as they get reorganized, he called it that, that we're going to get some help in that regard. Personally, I think that is going to be our ultimate relief. You know, if you look at our success with Kaiser Permanente, it's been minimal. Hopefully our success with Primera and LifeWise will be much better than minimal. But that said, it's like a game of chess in a way. Yeah, you have LifeWise in hand this year or 2020 or 2021, and then they go away and they're replaced by one of the Blues or whatever, Regency. Then you got to start all over. But if you have a legislative precedent and basically legislative rules and regulations that are applicable, it will be applicable across the board. So I think regardless of our potential success LifeWise, we need to pursue legislative relief. Certainly the Board of Health, Department of Health, I think they feel the same way. I certainly do personally. And I think the other two PhDs are coming around to that thought process too. So I'm done. I forgot that. The really good news is, it's my understanding, and Pam, if I need correction to do so, that the market increase in air medical transport denials after the fact, starting in September of 2019, amounting to tens, 20s, and 30s of denied flights, has fallen off precipitously, not only in terms of new occurrences, but also in the face of the majority of those seem to be sorting out. Now, that's assuming that the people who are so afflicted, are willing to do the battle and go through the appeals process. But it looks like the success rate of getting those things paid for is pretty darn high. So that's hopeful. And I hope the word gets out, to tell you the truth. So now I'm done. Okay. Next order of business is new business, and that's resolution 19-5107 credit. Carl.
Seminole Island EMS has maintained a line of credit with Islanders Bank. That period had expired, and we're looking to renew what we had previously.
Same amount, same duration. I move that we accept resolution 19-110.
Second. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Unanimous. Meeting's adjourned. Thank you, Carl.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bev. And we tie for the...